24/7, bringing you some good music, freeform, meaning all sorts of music, no rules here. You can play, we have DJs playing all sorts of stuff. And we also have some talk shows, primarily. This is Talkin' Music today for the next 2 hours with Socialist Alternative Radio, a subset of that community base of WMFO. And we'll be here until, like I said, 1 p.m. with talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. We're here every other week bringing you some pretty unique programming. I can't think of any other shows exactly like this one. We're very much pro-socialist, 110% pro-democratic socialism. We're pro-union, 110%. We're bringing you information you're not going to get in very many other places, but it's not just about alternative information. We're also here to try to convince you, to try to get you to at least check out getting involved in the socialist movement, getting involved in socialism, checking out Socialist Alternative, for example, an organization that I'm a part of, checking out the ways that you can get involved in a struggle against the root cause of a lot of the oppression and inequality that you see around you, and that is capitalism. Unfortunately, we can't choose what time we're born in or where we're born, and you and I are in the thick of an economic system that's destroying the environment for human life, destroying, perpetuating inequality and racism and sexism over generations. And people are fighting back. People are trying to change things, but there are limits to what we can do under capitalism, severe limits, and a lot of the reforms that we win are then taken back, and we're going to talk about that a little bit today. You are, again, listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, and this is also WMFO Medford, WMFO in Medford. These are the magic words for our legal identification, and there you have that. So today, your host for Socialist Alternative Radio is myself, Jeff. No co-hosts today, no interviews today, and that's okay. We can't always be, having the group thing going on. Sometimes we're just going to do the individual DJ heroic martyrdom that you'll witness today. You'll be hearing today. Just kidding, by the way. Anyway, first, starting off with the new semester here at universities. Now, this might not touch most of the population, but you're probably aware, and it's a big thing in Boston, the Boston area is where this show emanates from, and I have to make that distinction because we do have international listeners. Check out Socialist Alternative on Facebook, Socialist Alternative Radio on Facebook. Check out Socialist Alternative on Facebook. Also go to socialistalternative.org on the internet for a lot of what we're talking about here, a lot of good stuff. And as I was saying, it's the return in the United States, most of the United States, it's now the return of students to college and high schools and so on. And the Boston area, where there's a lot of universities, and also out in Worcester, where I do, where I help out with building Socialist Alternative, there is a lot of colleges. And so you see a difference in traffic patterns, crowdedness on the streets, walking, if there's most American cities don't have any walking, by the way, but like here in Boston, there's places where you can still walk in the greater Boston area. And so it's a different atmosphere, and things like the new shows kicking up on WMFO and shows renewing themselves on WMFO, and it's there's a little more energy in the air and so on. And one of the things that we're doing in Socialist Alternative is that we do have student members, and we have student members who are engaged in student clubs at their universities, and we see the fall as a great opportunity to introduce a new generation of students or returning students to the ideas of socialism and how that is a key to changing the world, the key to changing the world, basically. And we are in this area sponsoring around the country, through Socialist Students and through Socialist Alternative, sponsoring meetings and sometimes debates. We tried to get a debate going in the place where I was active in this, and it didn't work out. The Republicans were too, I don't know if it was afraid or disorganized or both, to debate us on the question of capitalism versus socialism. And so we're having, where the debate didn't come together, where we're having speakers And we just had a very successful meeting at Clark University in Worcester. Boston branches of Socialist Alternative are doing similar meetings on the topic of capitalism versus socialism. And coming up at Worcester State on September 19th at 1 p.m. In the multipurpose room at Sheehan Hall. That's September 19th, 1 p.m., Worcester State in Worcester, Mass. The multipurpose room in Sheehan Hall, there will be a public meeting on capitalism versus socialism. Elizabeth Wixer will be speaking. She's a history student at Worcester State University and leading member of Worcester Socialist Alternative. She's written for Socialist Alternative, a national newspaper, which I'm going to get into in a few minutes in the show here. And she's contributed to the Worcester Organizer, a local publication of Socialist Alternative. So that's September 19th, 1 p.m. Worcester State. Now, for information on the Boston area meetings, please go to Boston Socialist Alternative on Facebook or Boston Socialist Alternative on the internet and find out more about the Boston meetings. I should have had that information right in front of me, and I don't. I apologize to the Boston members for not publicizing their meeting. I just didn't have that with me this morning. So, but there's easy way to find out about that. Just go to Boston Socialist Alternative on Facebook or Boston Socialist Alternative on the internet. Go to socialistalternative.org again nationally for more information about socialist students and Socialist Alternative in general. And this meeting, brings up questions that we're going to talk about some of them today. Can you have capitalism without racism? Is that possible? What is the solution to poverty? What's the way forward to end climate change? Does capitalism need inequality? Would socialism work in the United States? And these are some starting points for questions. We had a really good discussion in Worcester on those questions. We even had one person. It was interesting. Because I'm somewhat guilty of this, especially when I was younger, but someone playing devil's advocate, someone like thinking up tough questions and throwing them at the speaker and out to the meeting as a whole to just get a reaction and see how people would answer the questions. And so someone did that in Worcester, and they did it very well because I didn't know they were actually interested in joining Socialist Alternative, but the student was also decided to play, I don't know, conservative devil's advocate or something, and brought up these questions, which were fine. That's fine. It led to a good discussion, and we welcome that kind of debate. But he did it so well, I was like, well, that guy, doesn't, he's not going to be too interested. He put forward such a neoliberal perspective on everything, and he had like four or five things he shot out at us, and basically it was okay. The discussion answered most of the questions. And he, then it turns out, oh, no, he's very interested. He's very interested in joining, actually. He did that to see what we would say. I'm not recommending that because it's good to have some times and places where you can hear about socialism without, hearing simplistic propaganda against it, so you can go deeper into the questions that you want to go into rather than repeating, hearing the same old garbage thrown at socialism. But sometimes that can be good. Sometimes that's why we actually wanted to have these meetings in the debate format originally. I'm sure we would have gotten a lot of cliches thrown at us. But anyway, it's also good to have the meetings where you can delve into the more detailed aspects of socialism. And socialism is, if you're new to the whole concept or whatever, or you've only heard about it through people hostile to socialism. Socialism is, the way we're using the word, is not, it's not just like a vague, whatever sounds left is socialism. Socialism is really based on Marxism, and Marxism has a methodology of dialectical materialism to try to fit. That's a big word, sorry for throwing them out there, but it's basically just means, dialectical, it means, there's different aspects to it, but mainly it means how things interact with each other in a continual process of change. And when adapted to economics and politics and so on, that creates a very different worldview than, say, somebody that says capitalism has always existed, which, of course, is absurd, or that, human nature is fixed and it's this, which is also absurd. The way humans have lived has changed drastically. And the materialist part, you can probably figure out, dialectical materialism. Materialism is just basically science, facts, objective reality, and that sort of way of looking at things rather than a metaphysical, idealistic way of analyzing reality. Now, it's not quite that simple. And if you start to read Marx and Engels and others, you'll read how does a scientific-based, political movement interact with the craziness of you know, mass psychology and individual psychology as churned up by class struggle and by inequality and by unfairness and racism and so on? How does that how could you speak of objectivity in those conditions? And what Marxists have said and written about is that, and socialists, is basically that, well, look, we're not talking about being able to predict every person's last thoughts or the vicissitudes of a mass movement. You know, we don't have a crystal ball, but we can say, look, these are the general parameters. These are the general outlines of how the movement seems to be going, or how change seems to be going politically in a given time or place. And this is what we're going to be faced with as people, as working people, and how we're going to have to react and fight back and change and build our own alternatives, you know, politically. And that is very useful. That is extremely useful, because if you spend your time in the realm of ideas and idealism and how and psychology and so on, and never get to the root causes of things, never get to the things that really drive people in terms of trying to survive and so on, then you're just lost in, you know, moralistic assertions. You might as well be just, you know, guessing. You might as well be involved in some sort of religious movement or something. And that's not what socialism is about. It's about the reality of the world that we're faced with and how to change to a world where people actually control their own labor. I mean, we've talked on the show before about, hey, if you force us to give a soundbite definition of socialism, here it is: bringing democracy to the economy. Now, that sounds like a bit reductive, or a bit, you know, bringing democracy to the economy, how does that solve everything? Well, it doesn't solve everything, but it is the foundation for solving, you know, problems that we're facing under capitalism. And why? Because it will, bringing democracy to the economy will allow an international plan of production and distribution of goods and services for human need and not for profit. So it's the opposite of capitalism, because you're not producing for the profit of a tiny, tiny few, but you're producing for what people have democratically decided they want and need, and how it's to be produced sustainably so it doesn't destroy the environment. And this is completely different from capitalism, because capitalism is extremely authoritarian. It's authoritarian from the top, from the way corporations act, from the way the government is controlled by the corporations, governments in general under capitalism, and the way people are forced to act in the workplace, in the individual workplace, the coercion of being threatened with starvation or homelessness if you don't sell your labor. I mean, capitalism is, you know, the whole idea of capitalism equaling freedom or capitalism equaling democracy is such an absurd kind of evil joke once you understand. It's sort of like that movie They Live from the 80s. I don't know if any of our listeners have seen that film, where, you know, these two construction workers, or mainly this one construction worker, is, you know, being, you know, he becomes homeless, he's fighting for survival and so on. And one day another construction worker forces him, and unfortunately it's a bit of a force. It's a big kind of comic fight, almost making fun of violence in the movies and all that, to wear these glasses. And with the glasses on, he can see clearly that there's an elite, an alien elite, actually, not human, running society. You know, all the suits, when you have the glass on, the suits become, their faces are the aliens, and they're basically running the big businesses, they're running the government, they're running the schools, etc. And so it's a metaphor for capitalism, obviously, for class society or capitalism. How many people put on the glasses that can see? Well, it depends on the struggle. We're not idealists. We don't think that we have to go around as socialist activists and convince every last person of, you know, the methodology, the analysis, the perspectives, the potential and probabilities of socialism on an international scale. But and it's very hard to do that with the ruling class controlling the media and so on, the ruling class being the capitalists, the owners of the media and so on. But there is this relationship between people's experience, the objective reality that they live in, and consistently historically being forced into struggle because of that reality and looking for answers. And if enough people can see, can be discussed with, can be, you know, can just sort of even fall into the idea that, yeah, wait a minute, it would be better if we controlled, you know, the decisions on how things are going to be made in this area, or that this you know, workplace that employs thousands of people, they just want to shut it down. Well, why don't we occupy that workplace and make it to something we need? But that will be isolated, and they'll, you know, we won't be able to survive under capitalism. But is there ways to get resources to keep that workplace going that don't involve banks, you know, and capitalism? Or can we just do that for a short time while other places and other workers do the same thing, try to occupy, try to gain control of the political and economic process? You know, that kind of struggle forces people, and I'm part of this myself. I wasn't born a socialist. Forces people to think of a socialist alternative to capitalism, forces people to think of a way forward in the different struggles that happen. And it can seem to be a seemingly relatively small struggle, like socialist alternative was just involved in a community struggle here in West Roxbury in Boston. That's one of the neighborhoods in Boston, over the closing of a community pools. And we'll get into that later. And we got involved in that because, yeah, we want to see decent, you know, services for the neighborhood and for working people. We also want to, you know, connect the dots between that community struggle and other struggles happening in the city and nationally and internationally, and the need for socialism. And that sounds like a big leap, but that's how a lot of people get involved in politics to begin with. Like, why are we going through austerity measures in Boston? Why are they closing schools and closing community facilities when Boston is awash in corporate cash right now? And if you look at the downtown of Boston, the corporations are building these huge buildings, wrecking the city in some ways, by the way, building these huge buildings, gentrifying the heck out of neighborhoods. There's a foreclosure crisis still happening in Boston, from the level of working people. There's still a high rent crisis, obviously, in a city like Boston, and the people controlling all this, including the mayor, who pretends to be a man of the people. He's right up the butt of the big corporations completely, and just doing their bidding and getting their money to run for re-election. He's going to get it. Unfortunately, most likely, and he's gonna be another. You know, he's basically channeling this former Boston mayor named Menino, who had it down to a science. You know, Menino, like the current mayor, unfortunately, came from the labor movement. The labor movement shouldn't have anything to do with the Democratic Party, but the labor movement in Boston is, a lot of it is linked to the Democratic Party to our detriment as workers. And I'm a union member, and I can testify to this. So they go in and they use their labor credentials to gain some street cred with people. They, like Menino, this guy Walsh, the mayor of Boston, talks fast, to patter, blah, 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 with a Boston accent. You know, I'm pretending to be a man of the people or whatever. And I don't care what his background is. You know, he might be working class. I don't know. But the fact is that now he's doing the bidding of the upper class. He's doing the bidding of the corporations in Boston. And you know, he puts forward a progressive idea one day, takes it back the next, you know, and all he's really interested in is giving money to GE and other big corporations so they come here, and he'll get some of that in his campaign coffers, and the rich will get richer and the poor will get poorer. And that is business as usual in Boston, including from the liberals, including from the, unfortunately, a lot of the labor leaders, and including from the people that you know, they talk the talk, but they don't walk the walk, as they used to say. And that's a big struggle. But the original point was that through struggles, through the community struggles or union struggles or whatever, people do start to think about the larger questions. I know that's a fact from the struggles I've been involved in. And if there's a socialist there, a conscious socialist there to connect the dots and so on, then people think, yeah, that's, I got to be in this for the long haul. I can't just solve this problem because they're going to come back at us next time. You know, you get a good union contract, next time they're going to come back and bosses are going to go for concessions. You get an increase, a minor victory in a community struggle, and then the next budget comes down and they just shut you down, shut down your community center, shut down your pool, shut down your school, whatever. That's the nature of capitalism. Any reforms that are won are temporary. But we fight for those reforms, and we fight for those reforms in a way we call a transitional method, a transitional program, where we're taking those immediate demands that people understand and are fighting for already in a lot of cases, and we're fighting alongside and saying, this is great, we need this, trying to win those, but also trying to say, here are some other demands relatively speaking, very, very important to this demand you already want. Like, for example, if we want more, if we want the schools to stay open, if we want the community centers to expand, if we want more hours open for libraries and so on, then the capitalists are going to say, where's the money from? They're going to cry poverty. We have to free up the tax dollars from the rich, from the big corporations that are living off our labor anyway, and not increase tax on working people, increase tax on the rich, the big corporations, and get that money funneled into things that we want and need to make those reforms more realizable, even under capitalism, at least for a short time as we extend the struggle further. And then the question comes up, why are there all these laws preventing us from raising taxes at a municipal level or even at a state level? Right, and then we have to address that. Well, because they've written it this way, and they're going to make it worse. Look at Trump is going to do so-called tax reform. That's going to be reform, all right. It's going to be reform for the rich, for the big corporations. He's going to drag. He's going to give a few crumbs rhetorically to the working class, and unfortunately, some people are going to believe him because of the corporate media and so on. And we're going to get screwed even worse. As you know, as a working person, I can tell you, taxes are a huge, huge deal. A lot of upper class liberals want to just say to you, swallow your tax bill, don't complain, because it's progressive to want high taxes. That is a complete lie. It is not progressive to want high taxes on working people. That throws working people into the frenzy, basically, of trying anything to get out of that tax burden, including believing right-wing populists that don't... that are going to just try to fool them with a promise of lower taxes. But more importantly, the real money is among the big corporations and the super rich. That's where the real money is. You can tax us to death, which you're doing, by the way. And it doesn't generate enough money, or we don't control the money once it is generated. That's another part of it. There's austerity in the midst of obscene riches for the upper class, for the wealthy, for the big capitalists. You know what I mean? So, you know, if they're going to do this tax thing, it's got to be taxes, massive increase of taxes on the super rich in a given city, in a given state, and taxes on the big corporations. They're going around repeating in the corporate media that the United States has one of the highest tax, tax percentages on corporations, right? They say it's 34%, 35%. You hear different figures, right? And, well, first of all, it's not the highest, number one, but it is up there. But that just shows you that what the corporations have been doing for the last 20 years under what some people call neoliberalism, cis capitalism, but neoliberalism, which is rewriting tax codes in favor of the super rich and big corporations, not just in the United States, but in other very rich countries and very poor countries too, by the way. So you have a situation where the tax burden has flipped from where it was in many countries in the post-war upswing to where the burden was on the upper, you know, the richest and the big corporations. You had a 90% tax rate on the super rich under the Eisenhower administration in the 1950s in the United States, as an example. The people that started to cut into that, believe it or not, were the liberals. Kennedy started carving out more money for the corporations and higher taxes on working people. And then Republicans and Democrats have continued that no matter who was in power ever since then. Carter did big hatchet job on the working class in terms of taxes and a big favor to the big corporations. And that continued, of course, Clinton, well known for that as well. So basically, you have a situation where it's flipped. The tax burden, as they say, is on the working class now. But that's not enough. The corporations are always trying to get higher profits, higher profits, higher profits. They do that by lowering our wages. They do that by paying less taxes. They do that anything they can to increase their profit margins, their profit rates. It's not just aggregate profits. If corporations existed based on just, oh, we're making a little more money than we did last year, you know, in terms of general overall profits, then you know, corporations would be very satisfied. They wouldn't be trying to screw people over all the time like they are. But no, they want to increase their rate of profit. They say, well, we it's not just that we're making more money. Are we making as fast as we did last quarter? Is it going up as much, our rate of profit, as it did last quarter? If not, hey, we're going to close this down and go somewhere else where we can make more money if we have that power, or we're going to just double down and do more nastiness to the workers, pay them less, cut their benefits, cut their pensions. I work at one of the largest employers in Massachusetts, Harvard University. This is a really horrible, nasty corporation masquerading as an educational institution. Yeah, it's replicating some people for the ruling class, but as an educational institution, it's mainly a business. And I look forward to the day when we can take Harvard under public ownership and bring thousands of community people into the resources that Harvard basically locks up most of the year and or is in the process of denigrating and in the process of deconstructing, so to speak, or dismantling, like the library system that I work in. A lot of outsourcing, a lot of cuts, and so on, just as an example. But what I was going to really get into is overall, Harvard is this huge so-called nonprofit, but it owns actually shares in businesses, makes profits in real estate and business investments and so on, owns tons of property, and that's putting it mildly, in the Boston area, doesn't pay any taxes on all this. They have this thing called payment in lieu of taxes that they set themselves whenever they want, and it's just pennies compared to what they should be paying in taxes. This is just another example of the tax burden being flipped. Religious institutions in the United States also don't pay taxes. I mean, it's just a real joke. All the taxes are falling on our shoulder, on the shoulders of the working class. That has to change. And we have a situation where a lot of people that call themselves left or liberal don't even address the question of taxation on working people. They're basically like, swallow it up, swallow your taxes. We need every bit of revenue we can get. I don't know who we is, because they identify so closely with the ruling class. They throw themselves in with them, and the working people and socialists and so on, real socialists, are like, no. We already get our money stolen from us in the form of the value we create through our work that never comes back to us in wages. We're already paying taxes that we, in many cases, don't have any say over. And we're paying insurance. We're just paying for everything in this society, especially in the United States. And we can't afford it anymore. That's why the issue of stagnant and lowering wages is such a huge one in the United States, because people that even as corporate profits soar, people are not getting anywhere. Even as the economy claims low unemployment, that's debatable. Whether that's really the case, people are suffering, living paycheck to paycheck, making money that on paper sounds okay, but when you go through all the taxes and deductions and everything, that's not okay. Another example, just one little one. So a corporation like Harvard is always rapaciously trying to outsource and do things to save it money, to undercut unions and so on. So basically, starting way back in the 90s, Harvard attacked the pension system of workers at Harvard. They had a defined benefit pension. And as you probably know, if you're in the United States, the pension system here has been under attack for decades now, to the point where the vast majority of workers do not have what were known as defined benefit pensions, meaning pensions coming from a company as a part of your benefits for working there that people had to fight for. Through the union movement, and then it spread beyond union workers and so on. And that's been mostly taken away, and Harvard started to take that away back in the 90s, and they what's called grandfathered in workers that were there, including myself, back in the 90s, and they said, okay, you will have this pension, will continue until you retire. But what they didn't say is that they were going to cut the amount of money they put into that pension. And I don't have the figures on that, because it's pension rules and details are so opaque in the society. It's very hard. They make it purposefully confusing, very, very confusing to figure out. It's all weighted towards keeping you working until you die, basically, so they won't have to pay pensions. Like now in the United States, it's like you don't really get your full pension. Like, I think it's 67 now. And if you leave a place before those years in your 60s, you lose a ton of money. But this is not to indicate or imply that the pension you actually get is any good, really. That really isn't any enough money. It's not nearly enough money. Harvard's pension has always been known among those that have had to live by it as small and inadequate. So in the 90s, they said, okay, all you new employees, you go off into 401k land or, you know, and these you know, pensions based, they're not pensions, but pension funds, if you want to call it that. That's even a misnomer, based on, you know, stock market investments like Vanguard, TIA, CREF, and that sort of thing, TIA and all that sort of thing, right? So the people that have been there longer before 1991 or when 95, whenever that happened, were in both systems. But like I said, the old system, which at first I was told by someone representing the new system, oh yeah, your defined benefit pension will be worth much, much more than this one that we're introducing, in a moment of candor. And they laughed even. They said, ah, of course, the defined benefit pension is worth much more. That was based on the idea of defined benefit pensions back in that time. Now, the companies find ways, like Harvard, to cut pension contributions, somehow secretly for the most part. And so, for example, my pension, last time I checked on my pension, the one from Harvard for the defined benefit one was no better than the one from the from the one I have, the company that invests in the stock market. It's not because they did this great investment or something, because, you know, the recession, the great recession of 2007, 2008, and et cetera, cut into pension those funds drastically. It was just because the Harvard one's been cut back on, and I just got a thing in the mail a couple months ago that now every month this fee comes out. I think it's like $30 or something, comes out of my pension, because Harvard just decided to privatize, sort of, if you want to use that term, it's not the correct use of it, but outsourced, there's a better term, outsourced the pension, what was left of their defined pension administration to Vanguard, which is this financial company. So now I'm paying a fee. The money that was supposed to come to me as a benefit is going out partially in a fee every month, added up per year, to this Vanguard corporation. It's already swimming in tons of money. It's completely arbitrary, unnecessary, you know. And I just bring it up as a small example of the many, many, many screwings over, death by a million cuts, that working class people take in the United States and, of course, other places. Now, other countries that have a stronger left, a stronger labor movement, they still have more social benefits, although those are being eroded and taken away as well. And but it's really just criminal the way working people are abused in this country. Not to mention the constant threat of, you know, people living paycheck to paycheck. Are we going to be homeless in a couple months? Are we going to be, you know, whatever, locked into jobs for health care? But guess what? And I never see the corporate media talking about this, except one little allusion to it I saw somewhere. I can't remember where. It might not have been corporate media. It might have been alternative media. But do you realize that in the United States now, where people are trying to defend against Trump's attacks on healthcare, which we agree with, yes, defend, Obamacare with all its flaws, so-called Obamacare with all its flaws, right? Instead of getting rid of the bits of it that help people, but that we really need, and this is becoming more and more popular, and has always been more popular than we've been led to believe, we need a single payer system of Medicaid, Medicare for all. And that's becoming more popular now, and will be fought for, including by Socialist Alternative. And but meanwhile, while that ramps up, and the fight is going to take, it should be happening right now, and it has been in some ways at the state level, but the Democratic Party is now trying to control that issue, and they're going to mess it up. Of course, we don't have a party to the left of the Democrats. Not to imply the Democrats are at all left, but we don't even have an alternative party in this country, in the United States, like they do in many countries in Europe and other countries, to fight from the left to put pressure. Like, even up in Canada, the New Democratic Party originally was able to pressure in its formative years, pressure enough from the left to get their healthcare system, that their national healthcare system that they have in Canada. And so as we try to get something like that in the United States, unfortunately, you're going to have the Democratic Party, at least in the short term, running the show. And that's going to really, really hurt the scope and speed at the scope of the healthcare and the speed at which we get it, if we get it at all. But there will be a little more, hopefully a little more complicated than that, in the sense of the groups like Socialist Alternative on the left will be able to fight, you know, influence that fight and also help build in that struggle a alternative to the Democratic Party and Republican parties, in terms of the corporate parties, and that would be some sort of party for the 99%, workers' party, et cetera, that would be have that Medicare for all enshrined in their constitution, and you know, as you know, a big step towards just socialized medicine, national healthcare system, that sort of thing. Now, anyway, we're going to get into some things that are in the news right now, but from a different perspective, obviously. But just a reminder that we started off the show with talking about the, what did I do with that? Ah, yes. Around the country, Socialist Alternative and Socialist Students are promoting meetings, public meetings at campuses and debates and so on capitalism versus socialism. And the one I know of in this area, I know there's happening in Boston through Socialist Alternative in Boston. That has multiple branches. I know that Northeastern University, I think there's a meeting coming up, or maybe it's already happened. But just go to Boston Socialist Alternative for that information on Facebook or in on the web. But I just want to alert people to one that I'm helping with September 19th. That's September 19th, 1 p.m., Worcester State University in Worcester, Mass., and the multipurpose room at Sheehan Hall, Capitalism versus Socialism, with Elizabeth Wixer, a member, a student at Worcester State and a member of Socialist Alternative in Worcester, speaking. And for more information, go to Facebook, Worcester Socialist Alternative, or WorcesterSA@gmail.com. And also check out, as always, socialistalternative.org. Now, of course, if you have listened to corporate media in the United States, or if you're here in the United States listening to corporate media, there's been a lot on the natural disasters that are coming down, but are they that natural? Are they unnatural disasters based on climate change, global warming, and so on, based on the big corporations polluting the hell out of the environment internationally? And by the way, most, the vast, vast majority of toxic pollution or, you know, global effects of global warming from burning fossil fuels comes, yes, from corporate from corporations, not from individual consumption down the food chain, so to speak. It comes from the original, you know, production of the power or the products or the chemicals and how they're produced, long before we get to them or able to quote unquote choose what they want us to choose or let us choose. And that's very, very important to understand because, unfortunately, even to this day, a lot of so-called environmental speak, especially when it's filtered through the corporate media, is all about consumption for the bottom of the food chain, so to speak, us, and our consumption patterns and habits. If you just recycle a little more, we'll have a green planet. If you just pay more taxes, we'll have a, you know, green jobs, you know, and it's all a bunch of crap. It just is a way to hide the enemy, and the enemy of the environment is capitalism, and capitalism, the institutions of capitalism are the big corporations, the governments they control, the institutions they control, the institutions they support. You know, that is, and a lot of that is, in terms of the corporate end of that, is of course fossil fuel burning, technologies that are profitable versus technologies that are green. And there's all excitement when on the, you know, from liberal environmentalists and others, when there is some green technology implemented here or there. Now look carefully though at that, those situations. That's where the left is stronger, you know, including maybe the left of the Green Party. And in some places, the Green Party in some places is doing austerity and other nasty things, despite its name. But and that means that, so for example, in countries where there's a stronger left, for right now at least, more investment by the government into green technology and subsidizing that technology. I mean, we could eliminate, even under capitalism, we could eliminate cars, personal transportation based on, you know, oil and gas. But it would take a heavy subsidy, you know, take a big chunk out of the military budget, tax the rich and the big corporations more, and you'd have the money easily. But it would take a big subsidy for the average person, right, that wants to buy a car, to be able to afford an electric car the way they're put out now. Maybe, or the government could start manufacturing cheap electric cars. That would be actually a better solution, rather than giving money to the corporations that exist out there that make electric cars. So if Tesla or whatever claims they can't make an electric car, or GM, I mean, a lot of them are being made now, but they're not being marketed at a price that people can afford. They're not being sold at a price that people can afford. Then, in order to get to that price, you either have government subsidy or you have government direct manufacture and go around the big corporations. That would be preferable, and that's doable even under capitalism. Now, again, we would have all the same warnings. This reform, this will be short term. The corporations will try to control it. They'll mess it up. You know, they'll have electronic filling stations, so to speak, but the power will come from some stupid coal-burning power plant somewhere still, even as we're shifting away from fossil fuels or trying to, because they'll find that cheaper. And that's what's happening now. Wherever it's like one step forward, two steps backward in terms of the environment, wherever people are strong enough, the movements are strong enough to force green technologies, even for a profit, which is a contradictory thing, ultimately, then you have somewhere else horrible basic fossil fuel burning pollution still happening because it's cheaper, or because they don't want to spend the money on retooling, or because they're vested in ancillary industries that depend on that. You know, like, for example, the reason the United States ended up so dominated by gasoline-driven cars, this was not a foregone conclusion, even under capitalism, was that the capitalists, the electric car originally was developed at the same time as the internal combustion engine car. And they went with internal combustion engine car because there were things like oil and production, gasoline production from oil, parts and so on, that they were confident, and it turned out to be true for the most part, they could make more money going that way than the electric car route. And they went ahead and did it. And then when that still didn't take, when most people could not afford cars, and there was mass transportation, believe it or not, in places like Los Angeles and many other places around the country that are now woefully lacking in public transportation, there was trolley systems, there were trains, et cetera, in the 1920s and so on, and before, and a little bit into the 30s and so on, in the 40s. Then all of a sudden in the 50s, a combination of things happened, pushing for interstate highway system, pushing for the capitalists involved with car production and so on, those capitalists getting together with other capitalists involved in oil production, gas production, even bus production. Actually, that sounds like a contradiction, but they were wanting to go away from the trolleys to the buses, so it was a part of that. Rubber production for tires, all these things that related to all these big corporate, huge corporations that were related to growing car production the way we see it now. They basically decided they wanted to get rid of their competition, which was public transportation. And they did it. They went around in a consortium. They made a consortium. And this is very well documented, by the way, because they were forced into federal court in the 50s and convicted of illegal trust and so on. But the fines were minuscule and the profits were pouring in, and it changed nothing. The courts, the capitalist courts, don't really change anything, believe it, contrary to what people think. And there was no mass movement in the post-war upswing, no left party or whatever to call them out. And that went virtually unnoticed, that the big corporations had gotten together, the ones, involved with oil, gas, cars, etc., and other things, to destroy public transport in most cities in the United States, literally by going around buying it up and in some cases plowing it under overnight. People would wake up literally in some cities and say, try to go to the trolley, and there'd be a sign pointing them to a bus or nothing, because of this concerted effort by the corporations to hook America on oil, gas, fossil fuels, etc., and things related to the car, a car culture, as they like to say. It's not really, I hate when the liberals throw the word culture onto everything, right? That makes it sound like it's like this grassroots thing. I mean, that people choose that is, you know, culture used to have a positive, it still does have a positive connotation in many cases. So why throw culture onto a negative thing, a horribly negative thing, like, for example, car culture? You know, not that I have anything against individual transportation. I think that we need, in the future, we're going to have still have the option of individual transportation to places where, especially under capitalism, there's a lag of public transport. And the flexibility of individual transportation, I think, is still important. But it can be done very, very differently with electronic vehicles, by the way. So getting back to the point, though, of the unnatural disasters that are happening, it's the same thing with the way cities are constructed. This is not, you know, at some point, you have to look at the forces in play in the economy and in the United States under capitalism. That's the big corporations and the politicians they control and the political parties they control, the Democratic Party, the Republican Party. And this goes into how cities are formed, right? So, for example, in Boston, you know, along that same time frame of the interstate highway system under the Eisenhower administration and beyond, the movement to destroy, and unfortunately mostly successful, to destroy public transport, that and to, you know, weaken rail service to the joke that it is now in the United States, that there were other concurrent things happening, like, for example, how cities would be then reconfigured, and that is the word, reconfigured purposefully by corporate interests to accommodate the cars that they wanted instead of mass transit, the kind of living patterns they wanted. And this goes into things, this goes down to all sorts of things like segregated housing in the United States. There's a book out we've mentioned on the show called The Color of Law, one of many that have, not well known, but one of, let's say, some works that have researched governmental, U.S. government housing laws, and found that they were deliberately made as racist laws to segregate people, to create laws that the banks used and the banks in conjunction helped create with their corporate politicians, laws, and sometimes illegally creating loan patterns on housing that created segregation, even to the point of going into, multiracial or diverse neighborhoods and trying to undiversify them to create, you know, a monoracial situation, either way, through gentrifying and gentrifying deliberately, like only giving loans to, say, white people and white people of a certain class, and not giving loans at all or very few to black people in that area, or more, and that's called redlining if you want to look it up, or more starkly, just having that situation in many different cities simultaneously. This is the area that they're going to make loans to this type of person racially through their racial profiling through loans. This will be the black neighborhood, this will be the white neighborhood. And that sounds like, well, what are you saying, that banks and the government conspired and went around to segregate housing? Yes, that's what the book is saying. That's what happened, actually, in a lot of places, you know. And concurrent to that is how a city's going to look for increasing number of cars that are being sold at the huge profits, and wanting to keep that going versus the no profit of publicly owned transport. That doesn't give profits to big business, or the little profit of public transport even owned privately. So, for example, some of the trolley systems that they got rid of when the big GM and big car companies and others conspired to get rid of public transportation in the United States, some of them were privately owned, but they weren't producing much, or they were owned by little companies. And so, like usual under capitalism, tendency towards monopolization and just gotten rid of these little competitors in order to implement a general system of big highways cutting through neighborhoods, highways cutting through cities, highways elevated, highways buried, highways with belching out gas and oil, because that's making them tons of money. and that stuff wears down, and you got to get it fixed all the time, and blah, blah, blah. So anyway, here in at the same time is planning, or the lack of, or the deliberate lack of, or the deliberate planning poorly of defenses against storms and big hurricanes and so on. And of course, when Katrina happened, and I remember that really, really well, and Katrina did for a short time create a lot of questioning, some of which trickled into the corporate media, some of which was definitely in the alternative media, and a lot of which the left pushed on, of why, you know, the dams broke, why the I'm forgetting that word for the smaller thing. I'll just use the word dams. It's inaccurate. But why did the dams break? Why did the levees break? Sorry. Why did the levees break? Why did in certain areas? Why were certain? Why were poor, mostly people of color, concentrated in the most vulnerable areas, etc.? These same questions are coming up now with Hurricane Harvey in Houston, and now around Florida, the big chunks of Florida that are being hit right now as we speak by this hurricane. That's one of the worst. Now, whether or not these tragedies become as bad as forecasted, hopefully the questions they raise won't be buried right away. And again, if we had a big left party, if Socialist Alternative was bigger and so on, we wouldn't allow these questions to go away. And there's a good article in Socialist Alternative. Go to the website called Hurricane Harvey. Go to socialistalternative.org. Hurricane Harvey, a target made worse. A tragedy made worse by capitalism. And that's by Brian Harrison, Rami Khalil, and Patrick Ayers from September 1st, the Social Alternative website. And, it starts with expressing deep solidarity to those that are losing their homes or homes were damaged, will face hardship in the weeks to come. Goes into some facts about Houston and some of the, by September 1st, some of the wreckage and the loss that was known at that time. It's gotten worse since this was published. But here's the point that is never addressed in the corporate media in a macro way. Sometimes they get at little facts, but not seeing the whole system, or not wanting to, or not allowing that to get out. But, quote, Hurricane Harvey and its flooding was a natural disaster made far worse by capitalism. Two 80-year-old reservoirs, chronically under-maintained by penny-pinching governments, are leaking tremendous amounts of water, flooding many homes that would otherwise have been spared by the rain. Chemical plants, underprepared by profit-driven corporations, are leaking dangerous chemicals into the water, sparking explosions and fires. In the town of Crosby, floods knocked out power to a peroxide plant, causing the plant to explode, and the CEO has refused so far to provide much information. Residents near other oil refineries and chemical plants have reported an unnatural odor. A toxicologist for the Environmental Defense Fund, quote, expects a million pounds of toxic chemicals will be released around Houston just as a result of the storm and floods. Many of them are carcinogenic. That's from, by the way, a quote from National Public Radio, or as we say, National Propaganda Radio, from August 30th, 2017. Now, then a lot of the article gets an inadequate government response, which is very, very true, both locally, nationally. For example, government authorities failed to provide enough cots and bedding for evacuees, etc. Now, the thing about the damage done and the chemicals, like I was just reading one about like mercury being released into the water system. I mean, this is just horrible. And the nature of, you know, a lot of carcinogens that, you know, and the nature of like the way cancer is at least tracked under capitalist medicine and so on, is that some of the things that will kill people years from now, there will be no causal link made between, oh yeah, poor planning for profit, you know, city planning for profit, storms made worse by global warming, death by cancer from exposure or increased exposure to toxic chemicals as a result of this hurricane, and the lack of preparation, the lack of response, etc., and by the government. And then, they died of cancer, you know, 10 years down the line, in addition to all the other people killed by this tragedy, you know, by the hurricanes, we'll say, because we're talking about Florida as well. And you know, the knock-on effect of these of tragedies under capitalism is when you start to think about it, it's really horrible, really kind of mind-boggling. For example, I have heard a little bit, even in the corporate media, about this idea of evacuating an area, right? And this came up during Katrina in a huge way. You want us to evacuate. Okay, who pays for the trip? Where do we go? Where do we stay? Who pays for that? I mean, you've got landlords charging people rent that have already evacuated. How can I afford that? You know, what am I going to do without working? I don't have any money. I'm going to have less money than ever through not working because things are shut down because of the storm. And my landlord still asks me for rent. What do I do? Or you go to you try to get out, and the airlines are jacking up prices to take advantage of the crisis, right? How come the corporate CEOs that run the airlines aren't in prison over that? That's murder when you think about it. Someone's like, gee, I can't afford the $5,000 ticket now to get out of this area or whatever it is, $1,000 ticket, whatever. And then the flood comes in and kills me. I think that's murder. I think it's murder, or at least manslaughter, you know? I mean, this is, when you think about it, it's just horrible. How many people can't afford to evacuate? You idiots, they can't afford to evacuate. And then the evacuation is like, get on that crowded road, you know? Get on that road. Spend the next 2 days driving in the greatest traffic jam you've ever experienced in your life. This will be the nightmare of nightmares. And there won't be any food along the way. The food will be all gone. The water will be all gone. But go ahead, evacuate. And you might get some help, because there's good people that are trying to go down there and help on their own. Teamsters unions done a lot in this area, for example. Some city governments are providing aid from other cities and so on. But you're taking huge, huge risks when you evacuate, or you just feel like you can't do it. You don't own a car. Duh. There's millions and millions of people in the United States, a country dominated, as we just talked about, by car usage, individual car usage, who can't afford a car. I can barely afford it, by the way. They can't afford to call Lyft or Uber, right? Or the taxi. Because they're not even running, by the way, in a lot of these situations. And if they are, can't afford the money. You're gonna pay Uber $300, some guy to drive you somewhere that he's not even really willing to go because of his own situation, or her situation, to some other city. What do you do when you get to the other city? You know, I mean, this is the, in microcosm, capitalism, right? Everyone alienated, everyone on their own, you know. What's that quote? I used to say this quote a lot, and I've forgotten it, because it was something and God against all, everyone for themselves and God against all, or something like that. That's the situation that's in stark relief under the crisis times of capitalism. You know, a lot of the system exposes itself even more in a crisis than usual. And the corporate media tries to hide that. They don't talk about capitalism as a system having anything to do with this. They focus on people doing acts of charity, which is good in a way, that they show some of that, but they do it so much they make you think everything's taken care of. And then you read that, wait a minute, for example, I'm quoting again from this article from Social Alternatives website, Hurricane Harvey, a tragedy made worse by capitalism. Quote, over $100 billion was spent on Katrina in federal disaster relief, and it was not enough. People were still living in FEMA trailers 10 years later. And over $50 billion and over $50 billion in lawsuit money was paid out to 55,000 people from Louisiana, Texas, Alabama, and Mississippi because the trailers were found to be toxic. We should have no faith that Trump, the Republicans, the Democrats, or corporate America will provide for the full needs of working people, people of color, and all those affected by this tragedy. Undoubtedly, Congress will likely pass some kind of relief package, but working people will need to put mass pressure on the government to demand that everybody affected gets the full help they need. And again, mass pressure, yes, that will happen in various ways, but it needs to be, the most effective mass pressure would be if we had a workers' party with, you know, especially with union backing or some union backing, party 99% like that, you know, a party, a real left-wing party that could, on a mass scale, when something like, so see, something like this in a country where there are alternative political parties on the left, something like this could bring down a government. Something like this could cause a government to resign because they're not responding to the needs of the people. Here, doesn't happen. Because Republicans and Democrats, while they have many differences, they have many similarities.